Well, hello, superstars, and welcome back to another episode of Word Up with Danny Katz. Today I am joined by my friend, author, illustrator, cartoonist, Mark Shuram Sexy. That's how I pronounce it. And Mark just published a beautiful, super thought-provoking, quantum, multidimensional, and also very simple illustrated book called Field Guide of the Mind at the End of the World, Volume 1. So I invited Mark on the show to talk to us about his journey, his process, and this beautiful book that he has created for us all. Before we dive into today's conversation, I'm reminding you to click that subscribe button to like, to share, to comment, to send this episode to at least three friends so that we can expand our tribe. It's a more the merriest kind of situation here. You are an integral part of that. So thank you for your ongoing support. I'm also reminding you to sign up for my newsletter at DannyKatz.com. It's the best way to ensure that we get to stay in touch, that you get to stay imprised. Imprised? I don't think that's a word yet. That you can stay apprised of all my latest offerings, new book drops, new courses, new webinars, live events, all those fun things. So you can sign up over on DannyKatz.com. Also reminding you that The Language of Betterarchy is available in print, ebook, and audiobook and makes for a fantastic holiday gift, along with my illustrated guide to propaganda, Word Up, Little Languaging Hacks for Big Change, and my newly revised Yes I Am transformational coloring book for kiddos, grown-ups, and everyone in between. And of course, Mark's amazing book, Field Guide of the Mind, which is on sale now. That does it for housekeeping, for pitches, for nudges to support me and other authors like me. Now is a great time to make yourself a nice beverage, buckle up, and prepare to enjoy my conversation with Mark Shuram Sexy, author of Field Guide of the Mind. Mark, hey. Sure I am sexy.
Hey.
How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. Where are you joining us from today?
At this moment, I am in Las Vegas for now. I've been here for a few weeks and I've been kind of, you know, hitting events around the country from here.
What's the vibe like in Vegas right now?
Well, my own personal sense, because it is a swing state, the anxiety level feels really high. Like it started last night. I'm really empathic because of the nature of my work. Mm-hmm. And I'm feeling like this real intense anxiety in the air itself. And it's pretty overwhelming in a sense, but it's like, I have no, there's a pressure going on right now that people are experiencing it. But yet for the most part, I am mostly running into like really lovely people.
Nice.
You know, so I can't say that, you know, I mean, there's always jokers you're going to see that, that take things really, really seriously. I saw a funny sign today that made me laugh. It was because usually on the left side, there's no sense of humor, but it was a Harry Waltz sign with a cat on it.
I like that.
That made me laugh, you know, because that's funny. And yeah. So I was, you know, and, you know, I think, you know, most people really want peace. There are those that, I mean, on both sides are really fearful and they might have a derangement syndrome for both candidates, you know, but I don't know. I have a lot more faith in people because I think just the ant farm gets shook up by the media. I was in the gym at a national chain and they had a lot of TVs, like way too many TVs, but they had different channels on and all the news, different news channels had like a similar poll with the results opposite of each other. It's like literally this consensus, or the not consensus, but this confirmation bias chamber is just giving people what they want to feed the beast or their fears. And so it's important to detach from that.
100%. So just to let the audience know, because our show, we're recording the day before the United States election, and our show's not going to come out for a few weeks, but just so folks know, this is what we're talking about. Do you see equal Trump, Harris signs in Vegas?
Mostly I see Trump. The only place where I saw a more equal distribution was in Arizona.
Oh, that's interesting.
Just where I was, but I mean, there's a lot of desert lots there, so I don't know if people are just putting signs down in a guerrilla fashion. One thing I'd like about Vegas is that all the big signs that are put out here, someone has taken the care to put mustaches on everybody, and I appreciate
Oh, I love
that. Like there's big, everyone's got a mustache.
that. That I like. Awesome. Do you vote? Are you allowed to vote in US elections?
In some states I am, but otherwise, no, I'm
Is Nevada
Canadian.
one of those?
No, I'm not even gonna try. I'm a guest in this country. I'm not doing it.
Well, we're happy to have you here.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for making it sparklier here.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Happy to be here.
So we're here to talk about your brand new book, Field Guide of the Mind at the End of the World, Volume One. I'd just like to take the rest of the time unpacking the title. I feel like I could do like a full-on doctoral thesis on just the title. So let's break it down.
All right. Do you want to start and want me to start?
You start.
Okay. So, in this intense psycho-spiritual journey that I've had, that probably started in 2007 with a, I'll just say, a spontaneous Kundalini awakening when I was minding my own business,
Okay.
that I
When you say
said,
you were minding your own business, were you like in a meditative state? Were you
no,
exploring?
I was using my chainsaw and I was cutting up some wood.
That sounds dangerous.
No, it's like I think that's the grace of God. Like people do a lot of techniques, but I think you get it just because of who you are, maybe for some reason. Like there are a lot of people who will chase these things down, but it doesn't really happen. And then sometimes, you get whacked in the side of the head with something and boom, here you are in a whole different life.
So you're
So
holding a chainsaw. What happens to you?
it was coming on. It was like the sense of like a kind of like a, how a tidal wave comes on. They don't come on like a wave, it's like the water just starts to rise, and I could feel the psychic pressure coming on in my life. And at the same time, I was trying to maintain my old life. I was married, had a young child. Everything looked good on the outside on paper. According to regular life, but and I was profoundly unhappy with just the nature of how things were turning out. And so what I was doing everything I could to maintain that structure. So I was kind of pushing it down and doing things to keep that at bay. But finally, with a series of weird phenomena that happened, like just weird characters that came across my field and things like that, I just said yes to it and I tipped into it.
Can you give us an example of one of the weird phenomena?
Yeah, there was this being that I lived on a very flat open street on a river in British Columbia, and it was a wide street. And this one young lady had a beach cruiser bike wearing a white dress. And this is like a outdoor sports town, so seeing a woman in a dress is like pretty rare. And she crashes her bike right in my driveway. And I gave her some water, helped her up because it was just so strange. She was young. And for some reason, I didn't know her, but my whole soul knew who she was and I didn't know why. And that was the start of like these things happening. And it was this weird pressure coming on. So I can't say there's any story because I'm not versed in this. I'm just feeling psychic pressure of something building inside of me that's coming up and I don't know what it is. And I'm just trying to keep it down. I went on a motorbike trip and I went across the province just to ride and clear my head. And as I was heading further away from my home, I was getting happier. But as I turned north to make my way coming back again, I was starting to get unhappy. I could feel that coming on. It's like my child was two. I mean, he was just under two. So this wasn't like a decision that like I was thinking about. I was trying to maintain a lot of things together because this is life, right? But when I tell about that Kundalini experience, people say, well, it's all love and light, and maybe for some, but I think for most is that it'll pull your underwear over your head, and it'll punch you in the stomach and take your lunch money. It's a pretty rough ride. And luckily enough, in a weird way, when I said yes to it, then I first went to a pretty dark night of the soul. I mean, that was my first one, and it was pretty rough, and it rocked me pretty hard. I think I spent like 14 hours just bawling my eyes out as I relived everything in my life with perfect clarity, but just like as heartbeats. I'd relive a scene, but it would be the whole thing, but it would be instantaneous and it was like nonstop. And these kind of things that were just like the armor was burning off of me. And when I, when it stopped, like I was just in a state of shock. But then I knew that I had to make some serious life choices that weren't easy. And I took it seriously. And I was also unguided in it. So I'm, pretty secular life, so to speak, and a sense of, everyday Wonder Bread to all of a sudden I'm going through strange phenomena. But even my MD, the time when I was really kind of afterwards, I was explaining my symptoms, what was going on, like I needed some help with something. And he goes, he actually prescribed Gopi Krishna. And he was like, you got Kundalini sickness, and I'm pissed at you because you're a conspiracy theorist guy, and I do all this stuff, and you're having the Kundalini bent, not me. And but it gave me a bit of a language. And then, all my life.
Before you talked to your MD, did you have fear about what was
Oh,
happening to you?
this was horrible. I mean, there was phenomena. It was like, a half day was like two lifetimes. There was so much happening, and my mind changed from one mindset overnight to another. So my whole way of understanding the world changed. And it was, it's like a lot to take on where you have this like a worldview A, and all of a sudden then you have worldview B through Z.
And then while all this is happening, are your wife and your son are at home? Are you having to engage them as a householder at the same time this is happening?
Well, my experience with my former wife is that I kind of felt more like I was a tick box on a spreadsheet. Once, she kind of was getting what she wanted with everything, with the house and the child and everything else. And then I kind of felt like an ancillary character in my own marriage, and there was something that is an insidious part that could, if you let it in your home, is that will could destroy your marriage, is the home and garden channel.
Really?
Renovations. My former wife loved renovations. So there was a nonstop renovation going on that, as we're working on ourselves. And so we lived in the dirt for a year and a half. And then when just like how I'm not trying to throw under the bus, but it's like she didn't have the capacity to, even when I talked about we gotta do some things here to reconnect. And she would say, yeah, but as soon as she like I felt like when she turned her back, the topic was over because she was on to the next thing that she wanted to do anyway. So it wasn't like my needs were taken into consideration. So it was pretty lonely that way. And but yet at the same time, like I was committed, but I didn't know what to do. And so before I made any kind of thing of going down to say having affairs or whatever, just trying to get my needs met, I just this happened and I was able to, well, I mean, when you end a marriage, there's a fair amount of shit to eat. And so that's kind of what happened too. And that was like the rug was pulled underneath her feet too. But I didn't know what to do, because I could see when I could see over the horizon that one day I would hate her. And if I was with her, and I didn't want to be the example to my son of trying to be love with his mother, if I really despised her one day. And I didn't, we weren't fighting. We were just like existing each with each other. It was like a roommate thing, So it was, I don't want to give the illusion that there was anything like really contentious. It was just no connection. So that's kind of how it was. And so that's what I made the choice when he was two to like do all that. So this was all happening at the same time, and it was a lot to take on. And with phenomena and with the fear and with the wonder and the magic, and like just is a lot. But that's way back. That's also, I mean, I was like 37. So it's not different guy. You know, I mean, I've gone through places now with it. It comes up every now and then, but it's just the skill set I have. I can ride this stuff out, you know, when it pops up, you know, because before it was a lot of fear because it was unknown.
So you were walking a secular path. You have a spontaneous Kundalini awakening. How did your life change after? I mean, aside from the marriage situation.
Well, I should back up the truck a little bit.
Okay.
When I was 23, you know, I had actually got, you know, through a weird way, I've got into an animation studio.
Okay.
And I was working there, and some colleagues of mine, and I'm like, this, I understand, like, I grew up in a very sheltered kind of, you know, worldview of being in rural British Columbia. So, I mean, really, it was, the world out there was like way out there compared to, you know, what I grew up with. But these colleagues of mine says, we're going to watch this guy speak. And I go, well, I've never seen a public speaker before. And so we go there. And then, so this is a 94, I think. So for 4 hours, I'm like this. I don't think I blinked or I closed my mouth, but I got, as my red pill moment, David Icke live.
Nice.
Well, I don't know. It kind of ruined my 20s and 30s.
Really?
Well, think about it. Start researching. So once you go from a place of a certain worldview, and then I started like searching and researching the books and everything else, you know, it does kind of ruin the joy of lots of things, because then you start to see, you know, how the hot dog is made.
Right.
You know, and I'm 23, going from like one worldview to another immediately with no warm up.
So give us an example of what pieces of joy David Icke took from you in your early 20s.
Well, it was more in that extreme conspiracy side of things. There's looking for a boogeyman here or there, right? There were things that was so shocking that that's what probably got me, was like a lot of people will get stuck by shock, right?
Yep.
So if you look at what happens, if they get shocked, you know, they'll most likely believe it more than something that's true.
Yep.
So I would start to look into these things, and there's a lot of it that was valid. And there are things that I can't corroborate, but I had events happen that, yeah, there was something to a lot of it. With my work, when I was drawing at parties, I'd be different kinds of events and I'd talk to people, and, you know, I could be like at a finance party or something like that, drawing, and I'd ask questions, and I'd ask for people to basically ruin that worldview I had, and they would just reinforce it. Oh, no, that's right. You know, like I sat with, I was riding a train from Montreal to New York, and it was like 98. And this guy was a rail historian from Princeton, you know, from the kind of the American aristocracy, I guess, but he was a train enthusiast. So train enthusiasts are high detail people.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I kind of once again gave him the spiel of what I saw, and he goes, you know, about, you know, cartels and how things work. And he goes, you could tell me if I'm wrong, because he also was offered a seat on this Council on Foreign Relations and things too. So they were just chatting about, you know, life. And he said, no, you're right. And I go, I'll do one more for you. I was at a party in Boston or somewhere in New England, and it was in the 50s, you know, during the Cold War. And some guy was showing everyone his bomb shelter he made. And then some spook guy came by who was like some kind of like hidden wheel in the government, says, save your money. Ain't nothing going to happen. We control both sides. And I'm like, oh, okay, well, what do I do with that? But this, like, you get information. What do you do with things? Because once again, you have a limited worldview, and you might get a tidbit here or there, but then you could take that and make your mind a mess with it, right?
Yeah.
It's totally. So easy to do. I mean, that's with anything, you know? So through the years and different things that I did, you know, the mental discipline became very, very clear. It's what's most important in everything you do, because otherwise it just makes a mess.
Yeah. So you discovered David Icke in the early 90s. You become a quote unquote conspiracy theorist.
Well, more like a enthusiast, I guess. I was just once you know, when you get that bug, you can't help, because then you just start pulling the thread in the sweater, right?
Do you think it was the thread pulling that contributed to the Kundalini awakening? Do you think it was lifetimes of effort? What's your take on it?
I wonder, because I was feeling a complete heart absence of my life at that point. So I was pretty miserable. Mm-hmm. And I think it was a course correction. So it went from, you know, because I was actually dropping everything. I was letting go of all of it. Everything I was into, I was putting it aside to maintain my life so I could just have a normal life. And then this thing happened and it took me down the mystical path. So it's, I mean, I can't say I was courting it, but here I am, right?
And so what were your first, I mean, Kundalini awakening aside, what were some of your first moves on the mystical path? Were there any sort of like teachers or modalities or traditions that called to you more than any others?
No, it was like a series of people that come through my realm, or through, not through my realm, through my field, that were like teachers. Some were beautiful, and some I would call were, you know, hyenas, you know, because a dinner bell was there. I think the first one I had the 46th son of the last king of the Punjab as my house guest, who was a Vedic numerologist.
Okay.
For real. Like, yeah, he was a devotee of Sai Baba. And, you know, he was in that world. And, you know, I kind of learned my first thing about yogi repellent, kind of get out of your house too, you know. But I mean, there's a lot of things I learned, and there are things that he said that are, you know, have come true, so to speak.
Did he have questionable morals? Like Sai Baba is rumored to also be working with?
I think he played things a little fast and loose, but that's a lot of teachers, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm hyper, like super vulnerable, because I am like stunned from having my insides ripped open, you know, energetically, and then dealing with stuff. So, you know, I was looking for a teacher too. So, I mean, the dinner bell was ringing.
Right.
I had a, you know, beautiful one where like there were things that, there was like some external clairaudient guidance happening, or internal external. Had a phone call from this person who was looking for their cartoon that I drew months earlier. And this presence goes, "This is important. Whatever happens, go with it." And so I said, "Oh," like, she, I said, you know, she's, I said to her, I go, "I'm going through something kind of weird, and apparently you can help." And I said, "The veils between the world are kind of thin for me right now, and I'm kind of a foot in both." And she said, "Oh yeah, sure, I can help." And so she came over to my place, and she lived three blocks away. And, she's a tantrika, and actually she lived at Rajpuram with Osho.
Whoa.
Yeah. But, you know, I ended up going for a session with her. It was my first time with real presence with somebody, mm-hmm. but because of the energy that burst out of me, it kind of blew past her boundaries, and we became lovers for a few months, you know, so it's a deep training that way with someone who was like versed in that part of the world and that stuff. And that was, you know, very helpful, which got me to lots of other things. And there, like say, people would come through and there'd be lessons. I mean, like, you know, under black magic attack for a time, you know, I had to find my way out of that, you know, I was learning about, you know, how that really will just, it, what happens with that is it makes your own mind attack yourself and you get weak. And that was like a woman who was a Native woman, who was looking to, she took a shine to me, but then she was also a psychologist professionally, ex-lawyer, and she worked for the crown, for the province, on a massive murder that was a murder, like a mass murder or like a serial murder case that was big in the province for a number of years. It involved lots of levels of different groups, and she was representing the families on behalf of the province, and she did a real number. Like, and I had to, remember when I broke free of, when I, like, it was, like I said, once again, I'm like fresh and new. I'm like very childlike on the inside. And mm-hmm. so she was like, you know, through gaslighting and through this coercion, trying to kind of make me into something that she wanted. And I remember when I finally broke free, you know, because it was crazy making in lots of ways. I remember, and this is right going back to how talking about your colleagues. When I gave her the notice, I gave her a letter. I followed her on my motorbike. I saw her on the street. I followed her, handed her the letter, say, "I'm, you know, breaking my connection with you." 24 hours later to the minute, I felt like I woke up from a spell. It was literally the feeling like, how did I get into that? It was like something lifted off of me that I was caught in something that I didn't realize. And so these things happen. I think people, we do get stuck in things we don't realize, you know, that there's a hypnosis, a spell, something like that. Something, I mean, I've seen, you know, astral entities that'll come and try to feed on you, they'll try to scare you, but they're just like these maggots try to just munch on your energy field more than anything else, right? They really can't do much, but you get scared, and then that's where they have their power.
All right, so I want to go back to this native woman. You mentioned the under the spell of black magic, one's mind works against themselves, right? Which absolutely ties in to feel guide of the mind and this beautiful I want book I want to make it more like magnificent than book, but book is magnificent that you've created. But did you contract with her in such a way that gave her entry into your mind?
Yeah, she found my thumb screws, so she used me. She could see I because I had gone through something, and so my energy field was very different. And you know, she looks like, "Wow, there's something different about you," you know. And I'm like, I had my armor ripped away, and so I was, you know, very, you know, just really light, you know, in many ways. Of like some of the guy I was before was very different, but I'm the same. But you know, there's a, you know, like someone's energy is like BO or it's sweet, you know. It was like my energy was different, and so she had concocted some kind of story that to hook me in, which I resisted for a long time, but I, you know, I finally went along with it because, you know, that naive part of me, well, I went through all this like shit, it must be for a good reason that would allow me to, you know, do some good in the world. But this was a beautiful, harsh teaching, you know, as far as talk is cheap and look at their actions. And, you know, you have to be aware of your own thumb screws in life of what was being screwed down on me. And so it's not like, you know, I'm gonna be blame or shame about it. You know, she was trying to get herself fed her energy, you know, and I was right there. And I remember this is funny. I had a dream about her, and I was in a dream state, like a lucid dream state, and I was giving her shit about what she had done, and she's like, "You called me in." It's like, okay, like I mean, I don't know what that meant at the time, but you know, I don't know what to do with these things, right? But this was kind of what was said to me. I remember that when I'd broken it, I'd seen her about, I don't know, like a month and a half later, and she was walking by, and it was like a coffee shop, and she's like, "Oh, hey, how you doing?" "I'm fine." And she rubbed my back as she walked through the door past me. And as I'm driving up to an event north, towards Whistler, I could feel an energetic hook coming into the back of my back through my heart. And I'm like, no. And I put my energy field really strong. I says, no. And it retracted, but I felt it coming in. So where she touched me, there was something she was trying to hook into me again. And then I saw her a month later, and she was just scowling at me like an animal from across the room at something. Like it was like a weird experience that, you know, it was kind of bestial looking, you know. And it was just, okay, this is once again, it's right. So you're going through with these characters that, there's so many, and you know, but you can't hook into story. Like there's a lesson in a training, but you know, it comes and goes. You kind of just gotta like, you know, dust yourself off and then move forward, you know, and you know, go through your emotions you got to go through and face it. But I was young. I mean, I was really young with this stuff. So I mean, no, the training was only started like after, like say, with you know, that first Tantrika, but even that was still limited to, it took another 5 years before I got to some real training. You know, from I was in a teacher student relationship, also like a, not quite a discipleship, but pretty close with a teacher. And it was like a, I would describe it more as like Jedi Padawan. We spent a whole year together, like 12 hours a day. And it was like intense training and working through patterns and shadow and, it'd be alternate lifetime things popping up. It was magical. In the first 3 months, I was bathed in the light of God, like completely, like in a blissed out place. And I think because I was a, you know, really willing student, it was a blessing for her because stuff was coming through her to give to me. And you know, that And even that relationship, did sour, and like a lot of these do, like there are lineages of teachers, like through that are different countries, different places, that there are these disciplines, and I'm sure you've heard of them, where this goes on for generation to generation, teacher student, of there's beings on this world that walk around with a whole different vibe and an ambition. And they could be, you could be, like, say, you could be standing next to a saint and not know it, because your consciousness won't allow you to see, and a lot of times, you, because of the confirmation bias world, you'll kind of get a lot of what you're looking for, right? But I was blessed in many ways to get, certain people through my life. And then there are other parts that were, like other lessons, because it's, you can't hook in. There's a place where you have to have a total equanimity. Equanimity, you help me with that.
Equanimity.
Equanimity. There we go. And that's the secret, because the emotional wave will just take you right out. You go too high, and then you have the pit of the trough coming in. That's a rough place to hang out. And it's like every trough will have the seeds of a, a peak coming again. But yeah, better to stay in the middle if you can, and appreciate, with, gratitude, if there's, when the times are good, right?
Yeah, that particular image of the vicissitudes in your book with the waves on the top, that really struck me. And I do have some more questions about your training, but I'd like to go back to the black magic woman. Because in my own spiritual path, like I have gone through phases of denying evil, denying darkness, because it wasn't something that I had prominent experience with. And then, through experiences with other people, I came to learn, oh, that is real. And some people are working with more nefarious intentions. And so you gave her a letter. And you said within 24 hours of handing her the letter, you felt liberated from whatever hold she had on you, whatever hook she had into you. How did you know to write a letter? Do you think it was in the power of the written word that this nefarious relationship was undone? I'm curious to know a little bit about how you undid that and how you knew to undo that.
I my internet funny, but I'm back.
Welcome back.
You
Can you
got
hear me
to,
okay?
yep, you got as far as there are people that are, and then you froze.
Okay. So what I was saying was, in my own path, I learned, unfortunately, through experience that there are people who are working with black magic. There are people who have more nefarious intentions. And I'm curious to know, you said you handed her a letter. So how did you know to do that? And do you think it was in the act of you declaring your sovereignty that her hold on you was undone? Like, can you walk me through that a little bit?
Oh yeah, I haven't thought about it like this. Yeah, I got a little help. Do you remember Kenadachi? You got that website, Educate Yourself, and there was a writer on there whose stuff really, like, for some reason resonated with me. But I was able to basically Hardy Boy and figure out where he was through
Okay.
just little breadcrumbs, and then I had a conversation with him, and he said that him and his group, they have a group of their, a prayer group, and they are also mystically, gifted, that they did some work on me. And it gave me some bandwidth so that I could write the letter. So I asked for help. First of all, I asked for help to get out, because when you get suffering, then you're not really, someone give you like all the, the secret to get out of anything, but you really can't use it, because when you're suffering, you're blind, right? So I got that much help, and then I wrote, I had to resolve, to choose the letter. I guess that act of sovereignty and following through with it was key, that, but I never thought of it that way. So this is, your question is, I just thought, it was like a phenomenon. I just handed it to her, and then, 24 hours later, I'm free of it. But I've also seen through different interactions with people where we get, we can be infected by many things. Like, say, I think one of the places where people don't realize of how much you can take on an entity is through intimacy. You know, I had experienced that teaching really in the spring of this year, as you know, when I was leaving somebody, you know, you met her, and I was in the room where I saw, because I was, as I was packing, I was actually smudging and I was listening to some scenarios from ceremony, and I was shown exactly where she had passed on an entity onto me, and I just started puking and like cleared of it. Like I could see, you know, it partly it created, I guess, me to be protective. It hooked me in a way that, you know, I didn't realize, but it was like innocent. You just don't think these things happen. I think a lot of people run around in life realizing or not realizing these energies will affect us. You, even though you may not believe in gravity, you're not going to jump off a building and fly. You're still subject to the laws of things. And I don't think it means being afraid of it. It just means that, hey, there are factors that we have to be more impeccably clean in our energy field to, you know, for our own, you know, highest and best good. Because it's not like, even there, that free love thing is dangerous in a sense, where you take on things, like as a woman especially, you know, you're extremely vulnerable what you take in your whole body. But even men too, it's like it can be pretty. I learned that one is interesting, you know, and through, you know, different interactions with people. And I think sometimes even our projections, we'll infect ourselves because we think that there's something, right? So this is just life. This is us, as we get older, we put on different big boy and big girl pants, and the parameters change for what's important, you know. Does that make sense?
It does. And I appreciate your perspective. I dip in and out of different kind of cultures and modalities and perspectives. And of course, because the bulk of my work is around the word, right? That when I've dealt with black magic or darkness in that way, I claim my sovereignty, I claim my agency, and it's done. And I don't know if it's done because that's just aligning with my worldview. That's its own confirmation bias. I know other people coming from other cultures where there's all this ritual and ceremony and time and things that they need to do. And I always wonder about not which way is right or wrong, it all works, but is it as simple? Am I fooling myself in thinking it's as simple as utilizing my language in the just right way?
I think it's whatever you need for you, because I think it's all first person singular work. It's about me. So it doesn't matter what society does, it's what you do, what I do, you know. Like, even like a lot of your work, you know, also inspired my work. I mean, in all honesty, you know, like somewhat like how you are, it was like it also fueled parts in my book as well. You know, because of that need, that freedom sense. Each person has their own need of what they have to do in this life. So we're, whatever life is, and I don't know what life is exactly. I'm experimenting with it more, you know, as far as what it means and what's possible. But I think trying to make a solve and make a consensus is a waste of energy. Kumbaya ends when the song is over and everyone goes back to their own bullshit, but so does Doombaya. It can be both, right? It doesn't have to be that way. You know, you have your own reason why you're here and your own stuff to work through, and you know, we have our own triggers and gifts, and I think it is a very personal journey. And then, as you know, we intersect with each other. You know, our fields overlap, and we're all in a reality bubble of our own anyway. So it doesn't matter. There's no consensus to be had. So I'd say, yeah, some people need permission with more ceremony. There are times I liked ceremony. I mean, you know, I'm fond of the bucket.
I wouldn't say I'm fond of it, but I respect your fondness for puking.
It's a good time. You know, it's cleaning out some stuff that's not meant to be there.
When did plant medicine insert its way into your ever-unfolding journey?
Yeah, it was a limited hang. It was started in, I think, August or like late July of 21, and it ended the October the following year.
Short.
It was yeah, but it was like every 2 weeks. It was a church,
Oh,
and
wow.
so there was, and I think I did around 20 ceremonies, but I was my approach to it was is that I was there to clean. And I was there for truth from God. So even if I caught myself tunneling, you know, you can get caught in some pretty wild stuff. I pull myself out of it and say, no, I want truth from God. So I just reset in the middle of whatever I was at. And even for me in the medicine, a lot of the, I was treated like a soldier in it. I mean, it was like stand up soldier. There were times it was fairly strict. And there were times that, yeah, I was like a starfish on my back lying there. I'm waiting to die. It's over for Uncle Mark. I've made a big mistake. And then when I kind of did a systems check and, you know, make sure I wasn't gonna like, you know, make a big mess. But then when I owned choice, oh, I chose to be here. Then whoosh, all of a sudden, then I'm teaching what happened because I had to own the choice to be there. Everything is choice. We're choices, but you're still a choice. We own choice in everything, and then that's, I think, part of the secret. So, like, you know, going back to your question of, you know, what's the right way? You know, you choose who you are in every moment. That's it. You know, you and you, and then we have this, you know, we want to help people, or we're here or not. I mean, that's on each person what they want to do. But still, we stay in our lane, and we give from our overflow rather than anything else.
I appreciate you saying you were put in that warrior position. That's always been my experience in ceremonies. I see people bring like their sheepskins and their blankets and all this stuff, and I'm like, what the fuck is that for? Like, I just sit here upright, tracking every, there's no laying down. There's no resting. Like, I don't know what that is. I recognize that other people have that choice. That has not ever felt like an aligned choice for me in those ceremonies. It
Yeah,
feels
and then that's where they have their own thing. And so, you know, part of it is like you ignore everybody else except for yourself. You know, you stay in your lane. But like, say this, for example, when I was in Vipassana, you see the pile of pillows I had to get comfortable. I had a throne because it
Like
was
six under one
hell.
knee, six under the other. So painful.
I had to open the closet of perpetual suffering looking for the right pillow combination so I could get through it.
Yeah, I get it. I totally get it. All right. Well, I'm curious to know how you got to writing the book. My ego's curious to know how my work helped inspire your particular book. But take us to Field Guide of the Mind.
Okay, well, it started like right out like after that Kundalini event, but I'd be drawing things and not knowing why. Like there's this the instinct to draw certain images, and I didn't know, but I just kind of saved everything. And they were, you know, it'd come and go. You know, I'd feel the moment, I'd just work for a couple hours, draw something. But what happened when I was leaving Central Florida in that relationship that I was in, you know, and this was someone like, you know, I thought it was like this was like long term, this was forever. And then leaving that, the floodgates opened. And all of a sudden, everything made sense, and the fire hose just came in, and now the instinct to start coming through. So it was like a channeling. I did a book in 6 months, the whole thing, and it was like a, you know, I'd get up at funny hours with a message, and I'd draw it out, and it was also cathartic because that book is also a life story. I lived each of those pages, and so it's not coming from a theory; it's coming from lived experience and my interactions with others and within myself. And witnessing of what I've seen around me. And so it was like, and that book has octaves in it. So where I'm at in my consciousness, an image will come up based on something I'm perceiving. It's really interesting. So as you notice when you said it was triggering in spots. or activating, that's
Yes.
what happens. Like I'll see something and I'll get a message and all of a sudden psh, the cartoon comes up, which is a fun phenomena to have. It just started coming. And so I was literally, the whole time I wrote it, I've been on the road.
Okay.
It was just instinctually I had to get it done. And there was more I could put in, but I just think to a play and then expediency to get it out rather than perfection. So that, well, that's what the volumes are for and additions, and I can adjust it as I go later. And so go ahead.
All right, so I want to pause because I have so many questions here, but we didn't just picking up the title. So Field Guide of the Mind, At the End of the World, which feels like a definitive ending, and then you have The Hopeful Volume One. So I
Okay, I gotcha. So everything in this realm we're in is mind, you know? It's like we're going through our own perception, like our perception of everything, you know, colors our joy and our suffering, right? So regards what we see around us, I mean, we're just taking it in. As our consciousness changes, as my change, parts of my life drop away that are over. It's like the end of the world. Also, right now, with things hot in the world, it feels like the end of the world. And you get a lot of people, you know, pontificating, you know, about this prophecy and that. And I go, well, I don't know about that because I think that that could be a reality on a timeline, so to speak, but it doesn't have to be that way. So I'd say our world ends every day, really. If you're choosing a new choice, an old world ends, a new world begins. And you know, it's the suffering of how much you're attached to it. Do you like I always wish people courage, you know, because as you're dropping the familiar, it's pretty scary. And to step into the unknown, that takes some real courage to get through that. And I think if anything, I wish anybody has courage to, you know, you face yourself, you face the lies, the beliefs of whatever we've invested in and the fruits that we've created in that belief and action from that. We're responsible for all of it. You know, even if we're lied to, like, you know, if I've been lied to about many things and I acted on it and it made a mess. So, you know, okay, well, let's clean up what I'm doing so I don't make a mess anymore and I have, you know, a better experience in this, right? And so, yeah, and so it's everything. Yeah, it feels like everything is ending, and yet there's tremendous silver linings everywhere, you know, that I see happening. And there are parts about the old world, you know, that I miss. And I had experience. Oh, I was listening to Dire Straits from like the Sultans of Swing album, and it came up and it just hit me like an echo because it was like a probably an emotional, like it was in the early 90s when I heard it. And I was thinking, that person, I was feeling myself at that time, doesn't exist anymore. That whole world is gone. And I could see I'm in a whole different reality than I was in that reality back then. You
I want to
know?
push back on that. I just want to tussle with you a little bit here. Especially since we're talking about the end of the world, which can, speak to this moment perceived through a certain lens, or as I'm also understanding it, every next day. So when you say that person is gone, there's also the notion that life evolves to transcend and include every version that came before it. So is there also a point of view where that version of you actually is still alive and inside you contributing to this amalgamation of versions of you that you're embodying in this moment?
Sure. I remember, I say, when I for example, I wrote my book as a quantum message in the bottle to my youngest self.
Yes.
I have had moments where I had one moment where I was having a rough time. This is in that early stage of that Kundalini part. I had a flash in my front of me of my future self came and comforted me for a moment. Like I saw myself. Like, you know, like, whoa, that's interesting. Don't know what it was. Like even if I think that everything is possible. I cannot begin to quantify or qualify what existence is. I find that I can't because anything I say is a model, And that's always subject to, paradox, and there's going to be someone going to find a way to blast a hole in it, which is just the nature of it. So I think being okay with not solving it is very helpful. And we just get through what's in front of us at the moment. We have our aspirations and we have our challenges and we work through that. Right. But I is there something there? For sure. I mean, this place is so wild of what I experience and see that is not what I was told and grown up in, what life was. It's so different. And it's also ordinary.
It's all of it, right? I mean, I would imagine with your Kundalini awakening that some extraordinariness has come online. And is it through the lens of the extraordinariness that you can now recognize the ordinary?
Well, you got to drop all stories, right? Because even that happened. I mean, it was a defined said yes to it, and I went on, and but I never think about it. It was a series of phenomena, and I survived it. Thank God. a lot of people don't. It's not a small thing. There's a I guess a maybe within how I'm. I was surprised even like through the great toilet paper crisis, how tough I am. I didn't realize that, given of what society was doing, of what I dealt with, that I'm still here, which is nice. I can't put any label on it, except this is what my life was. It was a series of weird things that went down, and I'm still here. And but at the same time, it's valuable for others because there's things I got from it that can help others go through, navigating this where they can see that it's okay to go into the unknown. Like you're gonna have to anyway. Like I never spent time meditating on what is the nature of God in spite of my hopes and my fears. I'm gonna deal with it anyway, right? So I would sit there and I'd kind of contemplate, letting go of any story or belief, and I'm like, okay, this is it. And that's like whatever, like dropping all stories, everything is secondhand that I would take on as from somebody else. You have to have the courage to go into your everything, no matter their word, but really, you have to find out for yourself for everything. If that was resonant to do that, right?
So field guide of the mind at the end of the world. I'm gonna step away from taking at the end of the world too literally, and I'm gonna trust that you believe that the world is going to continue on indefinitely. Is that accurate?
Oh yeah, it's above my pay grade, but I don't, like why not? Because I don't know what life is. I don't know what the world is. I mean, it's a series of phenomena itself that is also kind of paradoxical. So let's just, yeah, it's I'll say yes, it's going to go on.
So what struck me most, because obviously I've heard, you and I have talked about this book while you were in the writing of it, and I didn't realize how confronting it was until I actually read it and was like, oh, this isn't just a passive, let me read about the mind. You're prompting the reader to examine our own mind and to examine our relationship with our mind and where our mind is working against us or hasn't yet been wrangled to work for us. So, was part of your intention in writing this book for you to master your own mind?
Yeah, I'm my first audience. This is like, me first. I've got my own responsibilities, and it is, but it is also like channeled. It came through. I mean, it was downloading like crazy. So, and it was my first time that I allowed myself a project for me. Not just doing client work or stuff like that. So I put everyone else on ice for a while, and I just threw myself at it, and it was a joy. It's a joyful duty to do it. I've got more books coming through me right now, but I have to create the fertile ground again so I can let myself lose myself in that again.
That does it for the first half of my conversation with Mark. As you are inspired to tune in to the second half, you can find that over on both my Locals and Patreon communities. Those addresses are dannycats.locals.com and patreon.com/dannycats. At either or even both communities, because abundance rocks, for as little as $5 a month, you can get access, you will get access to all of my second half conversations, plus oodles of bonus content. Choose the platform that feels most aligned for you and meet me on over at either the Locals or the Patreon. Thank you so much for sharing your sacred attention with me. Thank you for remembering that every word matters, that you are omniscopic amazingness. Do sign up for my newsletter at dannycats.com and have a rockin' day.